Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Sight Side, the podcast where we pioneer the field of applied neurodivergence in the workplace and in life. My name is James. I'm an ADHD professional, an author, and your host. Today, I'm very excited to introduce Dara Broaddus. Dara is a fashion designer, a multidisciplinary creative, and an ADHD creative generalist whose work spans fashion, bridal, graphic design, brand work, and art direction. We met at the Generalist World event a couple of months back, and I knew right away I wanted to get her on the show. So let's get to it.
Dara, thank you so much for coming on the show. So first off, I want to thank you for coming on. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so happy you're here. We connected at the Generalist World event. It was awesome. You know, Kismet had us sitting across from each other. You were really, really supportive and nice. You know, we're all in this kind of deer in the headlights situation with this, this exercise, this workshop, and no one knew how amazing it was going to be. But before we get to that, can you tell everyone, just let us know a little bit who you are, tell us about your path, and just let us know who is Dara.
Yes, thank you again so much for having me on, James. I do appreciate it. But me, Dara, I am a fashion designer, multidisciplinary creative that spans fashion, bridal, graphic design, brand work, art direction. And I am a creative generalist at heart and also an ADHD generalist, which I think is very important to specify because I think the ADHD creative generalist brain works maybe a little bit differently. But I've definitely been on the journey of learning how my beautiful ADHD brain works and what it looks like to honestly use it as a superpower, because there are a lot of gifts and a lot of things that do come easy with it. So definitely harnessing those and then also giving myself the most support with the things that are a lot tougher, aka executive functioning things.
Right. It's I think that's so funny, especially as a creative person. Because I'm in the same way. I'm a writer, and I love the creative aspect of it. I love writing. What I don't like is the editing. I don't like it when it crosses the line from being like to a chore. You know, once the novelty wears off a little bit. So let me ask you this. So as a, you know, someone with ADHD and being a, you know, fashion designer, and I looked into some of you come up with some beautiful, beautiful designs. So what do you do when you're not in that creative space and you find yourself more in like kind of a maintenance or, editing or other, you know, other aspects of it that might not be quite as glamorous or quite as rich of a dopamine vein?
That is a great question because honestly, especially being in corporate fashion, like, yes, you get to design and there's a lot of creativity, but a lot of it is really like the production part. And a lot of that is like the emails and checking in with the vendors and communicating and things like that. So I've definitely had to learn how to attack those parts because those parts are not the parts that light me up, you know, but still part of the job, still have to do them. So it's definitely been a journey learning what it looks like to kind of have changed my framework, I guess, my mental framework and approaching, because I used to be very like, ugh, I hate doing this part. This is the worst. But doing that part is what allows us to do the creative part. Like, you have to have both hand in hand to get the final product. So I've definitely learned to take it in stride, understand that not everything is going to be the fun, creative part, but also systems, any systems I can put in place that make the things that are hard easier. If I can take 3 hours up front and set up a system so I don't have to think about something ever again, I will do that every single time.
That's such a I don't that that's a little bit of the tism showing through. That's definitely autism coding. I'm the same way. Like, I'll put systems in place that's going to save these steps like 3 days down the road.
Exactly.
And it's like, I think it takes a special kind of cognition to be able to even look at a project like that and see like, all right, well, if I do, you know, X, Y, and Z now, it's going to save me some time down the road. All right. So, Dara, let's back up a little bit. How did you first come to understand that you're neurodivergent? Was it like a slow buildup or a click, or how did you come about this?
It was honestly, the real story is that it was through TikTok. I did not know I was neurodivergent. I thought I was just like quirky. And when I was, I think I was like 24, 25, I started seeing these TikToks of girls with ADHD. And I'm like, Why does that sound exactly like my life?
Oh,
Like, how do you know exactly what's going on in my brain and you're just a stranger somewhere in the world? So I was definitely like, interesting. And around that time, I had just started seeing a new therapist, and she happened to specialize in ADHD and autism, which I did not know at the time. And meeting a couple times back and forth, she was like, yes, no, you definitely have ADHD. That is super clear to me, the way that you present. She like knew immediately. And in retrospect, I'm like, there were a lot of signs for sure.
right.
But it definitely wasn't something that was talked about much growing up. And then especially like you add the additional layer of being like a little black kid, it's like there was already a lot of it's already pretty hard to get diagnosed as a woman with the ADHD, especially if you think back like 20 years ago. But then you add that layer on top, and that was definitely something where I'm like, I wonder how and if that played a portion. But learning as an adult has honestly been, I'm glad I figured it out soon-ish, even though I was still well into my 20s. But I think it allowed me to just understand myself more. I think it allowed me to give myself a lot more grace too, because there were a lot of things I would just beat myself up over, which if I knew it was just how my brain was, and I could have just been like, oh, it's just how your brain is. You just need a little extra time here, a little extra patience, and you're fine. So I'm super, super glad that I found out and that I definitely had a hyperfixation mode once I got diagnosed, where I read like everything about ADHD, all the papers, all the books, because in true ADHD fashion,
It's wild how we dive into these rabbit holes with that. I it's wild. When I got my assessment, well, before I got my formal assessment, I had done some online testing, and I think I did three different ones online. They all came back that I was on the spectrum. So I compiled all of this into like a literal PDF file and sent it to the woman who I had already made an appointment for an assessment, but I sent that ahead of time. I'm like, well, this is why, because of X, Y, and Z. And it made me realize that normal, well-adjusted people would never do something like that. You know, that's something that's something that's so like neurodivergent coded. Like, who does a deep dive into this whole thing and then
100%.
compiles it in a way that is easy to digest? It's so funny.
100%. And I honestly have thought about doing it. I saw a girl on TikTok, and she was like, yeah, I just made a binder of all of my trauma so I could just give it to my therapist and they can go through it and we could just skip a lot of that stuff. And I'm like,
Right.
kind of smart though. I don't know.
Oh, to re I guess, because the first parts, they have to get to know you, and they make their own they make their own judgments, but it's kind of good to give them the kind of the biography a little bit,
For sure.
which is interesting. Okay, so let me ask you this. Okay, so when you look back at a younger Dara, okay, back let's say not before TikTok, let's say teenage years, right, adolescence, when you're trying to find your way in the world and really start to develop your identity as a person. And without having a word for it, knowing it was neurodivergence or ADHD, what would you say she was actually navigating? Younger you, that what were you navigating that no one was able to name correctly at the time?
That's a great question. I think one of the things was the novelty chasing, because I didn't really have language for that. I didn't really have a way to explain that, like, oh my gosh, I will literally learn everything about this thing, deep dive, buy all the things, start a whole business, even as a kid, and then 6 months later want to do it with a completely different thing.
Well, 6 months, that's a pretty long one. I have a most of my hobby graveyard in the garage has like a 2 week, it's about a 2 week shelf life.
And honestly, 2 weeks is like the ideal sweet spot. 'Cause it's like
Right.
dabble, dabble. Okay, that was fun. Next.
Oh my gosh. I was fun. I was just in my garage earlier today, and I saw an ice cream maker. I got really into making ice cream. Really big into that for about 2 weeks, and my maker's still out there. I'm like, oh man, I remember this. It's like one example. All right, well, let me ask you this. So since from back then to now, what would you say like stayed the same, and what were you always going to do? Regardless of what label you were, if it wasn't ADHD, neurodivergence, what was something that Dara was always going to do?
Dara was always going to be a fashion designer. That was like pretty much one of the first things I ever wanted to be. The first thing I ever said was an artist. And then I focused a little more and said fashion designer. I think this was at like 7 or 8. So that was something I knew I always wanted to do, something I always wanted to try, just because of how I loved how clothes made me feel, how expressive you could be, and the fact that everyone wears clothes, like everyone needs clothes. And regardless of what your style is, I love that you can kind of tailor that to different people for different things. So I was always going to be a fashion designer for sure, always going to be a creative of some sort. Because as a kid, it was always art class, it was always music class, piano lessons, all of those types of things were the things that lit me up as a child that I was like, I have to do this with my life because it just felt like it was a part of me. Like there was no other option. It had to be this.
Just felt your calling. Oh, that's amazing. All right, well, I want to know about your first project. Can you tell me about the very first fashion design, the very first outfit that you ever designed and actually were able to, either wear or see someone else wear, and you're like, holy, I created that. Well, walk me through that.
Ooh. The first one, I'll say this one. This wasn't, it might not be like the actual first, but this was the first one that was like, okay, I'm gonna make this piece. I submitted it into like my high school fashion show, and there were some judges from different fashion schools there and things, but it was this two-piece set, a little corset kind of top with the like blue, green, and magenta kind of like Nigerian fabric with a pleated skirt. And I was so happy and proud because at that point, I basically kind of taught myself how to sew at that point. So it was, looking back, it looks a little scary. But at the time, that was like my pride and joy. You couldn't tell me anything. I was so proud because I was like, this is something that started in my brain. And now it's out in the world and people get to see like something that literally didn't exist before it came out of me. So I definitely think that was one of the impactful moments where I was like, okay, wow, this is awesome.
I love that. And I could just imagine because I'm ADHD too. So when I can imagine when you're sewing, you have that hyper focus and you're just like locked in on putting it together. I could just that's those are the best moments. I get that same with writing. And I think it's like a creative, is there something to be said about actually seeing something you created?
100%. It feels like magic, truly, because
Right.
it's something that truly did not exist, that only you saw in your brain, and then you were able to bring it into the world so other people can also interact with it. I'm like, that's just so cool.
It's amazing. That's one thing I love about being like in this space and running into other creatives who are actually doing it. And that's the thing is like I really enjoy meeting other neurodivergent people that are able to get over that hump. And you know what I mean is like we are we're three inning ball players. We come up with great ideas on the front end, and follow through is not always so. It's not always the best. And in order to make something happen, sometimes you have to go through the drudgery. You have to go through the trenches. To push it out. So it's I th it's really I love running into people who are able to actually do things. You can either talk about it or you could be about it.
For sure.
Absolutely. Okay, so I know that your work spans, I mean your fashion, you do bridal, freelance, brand work. You've been in a lot of different areas of the fashion industry. Can you walk us a little bit through that arc and how one thing led to the next?
Yeah, for sure. So started off in bridal, actually, in fashion school, that was one of my focuses for kind of like my senior collection. So I ended up making a wedding dress, hand beading a shawl that went with it, and creating basically like a whole wedding gown collection. So that was definitely my in into the fashion world. And then once I had graduated from school and started looking for jobs, I was like, okay, like I really want to try something new, something that I haven't done before, which is great because there's lots of things when you're a fresh graduate that are new that you haven't done before. And I ended up applying to Abercrombie and Fitch and getting a job there. So I started off my career designing intimates for Gilly Hicks and got to design a lot of cool things throughout my time there as well. And then now currently designing plus size clothing for women at Lane Bryant, which has been really cool to start up there. But in the midst of that, I've done bridal freelance as well, where I'll help brides create their dream wedding dress. So I got to that for myself and for some other people. I actually have, I'm gonna show you since you can see. I don't know if you
Okay.
can see,
Oh,
but
I
there's
like that.
stuff I'm working on that's right
Oh,
there.
okay.
Yeah,
All right. I like,
it's
hey, just like a random what is it, a mannequin? Like, what do you, I don't know what you design. Do you call that a
a
mannequin to do
little
it?
mannequin. So
Right.
I have
Interesting.
it just looking over there in the corner.
Oh, that's so great. I like
But
how.
I've got to do a lot of really cool things in my career, which honestly has been relatively short so far. So I'm very thankful for the opportunities I've had and for how I've been able to grow as a designer. And also working for like global companies is kind of crazy because you could be anywhere in the world and see people wearing your clothes and things that you've designed. So I've definitely had a lot of very surreal experiences being all over the world and being like, oh my gosh, I designed that top.
Dara, I want to hear about one. Tell me, like, random airport somewhere, and you see a top, you're like, oh
Oh.
wait. Tell me about what's one that made an impact for you? One of these moments.
There was, okay, my top two. The first one was a solo trip I took last year, and I went to Amsterdam for the first time. And I was just walking around, like by the canal, by one of the main spots downtown. And I see this girl wearing this like nubby sweater that I designed. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. Like, I literally designed that. And then I keep walking and I see the store. And I could literally look through the window and see the whole display. And the whole display was of things that I designed. And I was just like, I'm in a literal different country right now, looking at the finished product that started in my brain. And obviously it's not just me, it's an entire team that gets product in the stores. Like it's designers, merchants, sourcing, planners. Like it's definitely a big team effort. But yeah, that absolutely never gets old, seeing it in the wild.
That's me. That's what a feeling, right? Wow. Did you go up and talk to the girl? You're like, oh, I have a top just like that.
Literally.
That's great. Oh, I love it. Okay, so is that like moments like that have to make you feel like you're alive, connected to it, which is, and that's something that's totally unexpected too. When you take a solo trip, you're not expecting to be, usually we take vacations to get away from work, but and
Exactly.
followed you to Amsterdam. Besides moments where you feel alive, as a neurodivergent, where do you feel like most out of place through this whole process?
I think one of the toughest things is figuring out where you fit in different systems and like systems that are bigger, whether it be like the job that you work at and how they operate, or just like the system of corporate America in general. I think that has definitely been a huge one in learning like what I actually need to be successful, understanding what I need in a space to be successful, what I need in other people, in myself, in the environment, things like that. So it definitely has been a journey learning those things. And I've definitely realized that I'm a person who highly, highly, highly values work-life balance. Because I can get burned out very quickly. So that's something that I very much prioritize and make sure that there's some good balance there.
It's very difficult to balance that, especially with hyper focus, once
For
you get on a
sure.
thing, because I'm not I don't I'm not going to stop till it gets done. I'll come with an off switch, and I think that's just something about our cognition.
Yes.
It's difficult to bad take the long view, or take the 40,000-foot view and back up and say, okay, I can it, I don't this doesn't necessarily have to be done today, but I feel like with when I'm riding that dopamine train, there's still that sense of
And
urgency, it's hard to get off.
100%. And also, I think one of the things that makes it really hard to not fully rely on it is I know I can get a lot of shit done during that
Right.
time. Like that first, especially like that first, if I'm working on a new project, the first like month or so, I'm like, I could do in a month what some people could probably take a year doing because I know that I'll just be like, oh. But then, then there comes the issue of because I'm so locked in here, everything else falls to the wayside. So there definitely does. I'm still learning, like, what does it look like to both harness the hyper focus and like use it as fuel, but also not burn out super
Right.
quickly.
Well, let me, how does that work in a obviously, because you mentioned, any of the fashion products that you guys put out is a part of a team effort. What does it look like for you when you are in one of those hyper-focused tunnels, and yet you're part of a team and you're working with holistic minds that just can't keep up? And how do you handle that type of professional latency when you're like all, way, way ahead and you're doing a year's worth of work in a month and everyone else is doing a year's worth of work, year's worth of work in a year?
Real. I think honestly, one of the things has been like slow down a little bit. It's like, okay, oof. And something that I've also realized is prioritizing where it is that I want to give my fullest 100% energy. So for me, I am always going to give 100% in my resources, energy, time, especially if it is something that I own, is something that is kind of like my brain baby. With corporate, obviously, since there are so many hands that touch it, you do have to have much more open hands, especially when it comes to creativity and design, because it's not just what you want that matters at the end of the day. Like, there are still targets that you have to hit number wise. There are still plans that you have to hit. You still have to communicate with different vendors and make sure things are on cost and things like that, which can all impact design. So I think in those situations, a lot of it has been slowing down for me a little bit, looking around, and also just assessing like who's on the team, because not everyone wants to be an innovator. Not everyone wants to be pushing things forward. Some people just want to show up and do their job, which is absolutely fine. But I found that I definitely am a bit of a disruptor, definitely an innovator. So I definitely try and find other people who kind of have that same spirit, who are always looking to see, like, okay, we have this thing, it's working, but it probably could be working better. So how can we get it up to speed to where it's working at a better place, which then gives us creative time back, which designer doesn't love more creative time,
And it's funny how that works, because water always seeks its own level, and we always find our people. You're always gonna find whoever's on your frequency or at the same
Exactly.
vibe. We always find it. Okay, well, let me ask you this as a and as you could tailor your answer, because I understand you have a career, and I know I'm not trying to get you in trouble with your bosses or anything, but do you what how do you deal with friction when you are in a situation when you're coming in from a love of design and creativity, and the company you work for is coming in with a love of making money? Obviously, they only are going to back designs that are going to sell. How do you navigate that friction?
I mean, a lot of it is just conversation, communication, and curiosity, honestly. Because at the end of the day, like for fashion, it is a business. So you do have to take into account the business portion. But also, we have to take into account that, especially when it comes to women's fashion, like women want things that are new, they want some trend, they want things that will make sense for them and for their life and for the things that they do. So I'm always going to lead with that. I'm like, even if it's like, okay, we have to make X cost, then we have to cut this, I am always going to put the customer first, in how I design anyway, even if we do have different constraints. So usually that just looks like prioritizing, okay, like what is the best thing we can do in the situation where we can meet, obviously, like the cost requirements, the business plan requirements, but also create something that is a great product and that she actually would want to spend her hard-earned money on, because that is a lot to ask for something that is not like necessary for life. This is a tertiary purchase. It's not something you absolutely have to have. So I personally want to make it worthwhile. If you're going to spend money on something, I want it to be something that is cute, something that you like, something that's comfortable, something that makes sense for your life, and that you actually feel like you have value from it. Because there's a lot of things in this world that want us to give our money to, So I do try and be very mindful of that. Pockets is a big one for me. I despise when women don't have pockets. So very rarely do I ever design anything without pockets.
It's one of the things I love about like anytime any woman with it, if I say I love your dress, they'll say, oh, it has pockets, and then they show you. It's always like they have to
Exactly,
do it because
because
it's those like pockets on
that's a
dresses. It's
selling
like
point.
it's such a that's so funny. I love that. And you as a designer, you understand. I mean, someone because they started designing dresses with pockets. So designer somewhere on the line was like, "Hey, we need pockets," which is
100%.
fantastic. All right, well, let me ask you this. I understand you design for plus size women, among a lot of other things. What does it actually take to do that well? Like, what parts of the craft do people who are outside of the work never get to see?
I think a lot of that is understanding the customer, which I talked a little bit about that earlier, but you can't really make clothes for someone that you don't understand, you know? So if you don't understand like what she does in her free time, how she likes to spend her weekends, what kind of like hikes she likes to do, or the kind of media she likes to consume, because all of that really does affect the clothes that you wear. And I think a lot of that work is what helps make good products. Because at the end of the day, there are lots of people making lots of things, but there aren't as many people making things that people actually need and specifically want. So I think that's a huge, 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 huge thing for me in making sure that whatever we're designing, we're asking, like, okay, what is the intent of this? How is she using this in her life? Is this a pant that she's wearing to work? Is it something that's versatile that she could wear to a baby shower and then wear to the park? Like, what is she actually doing? How is she moving? And then based on that, what does she need in her clothing to be able to do that? So it's definitely a lot of that, a lot of psychology, honestly, which I personally really love. And I've done a whole deep dive into UX and doing UX design and research. That was one of my little side quests that I did.
Side quests, all right.
But that really, I think, informed my fashion design as well, because it really taught me how to prioritize the user and how to remove barriers and constraints so that we can actually give the user something that they want, something that they can easily find, easily wear. Yeah, because like I said, there's a lot of things in the world that there's excess in a lot of things. So if we're gonna be making things, let's try and make things that have purpose and yeah, can be used mindfully.
How would you a thought occurs, like if you are designing a piece of clothing, like do you look at it as something that would be versatile that they could use for multiple things, like not necessarily work, if it's like a nice blazer or something they could wear to a social function or different things, or if they have a like weekend clothing, you're right, that's a whole other thing. I mean, someone can be a lawyer Monday through Friday and they're riding a Harley from Saturday Sunday, they're out
Exactly.
leather chaps, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, like how do you determine how versatile a piece of clothing is going to be?
I mean, a lot of that is not just determined by the designers, but also determined by a lot of like merchants and planners who kind of oversee the more business part. At least where I am currently, the business is very split between more casual and more refined. So it's usually like a good kind of mix between the two. But what is interesting though is seeing how much culture and what's going on in the world affects fashion and other industries. Because even since COVID, like pre-COVID, like the work pant was like a huge thing. And then COVID happened. Everyone was inside. Everyone was inside wearing elasticated pants for a year. And it was kind of tough to get back to more structured pants because we all got used to wearing stretchy, comfy clothing. So seeing how that impacted the industry and how that affected like the types of clothing people would shop for. Even with Bridgerton, when Bridgerton came out, corsets were everywhere. You couldn't go anywhere without seeing a corset just because of how much that media has invaded life in general. So it is always interesting seeing how the world around us also impacts these things too.
I just had to Google what Bridgerton is. Okay, I see now. All right. Sorry, I'm a sci-fi guy. I have no idea, but I'm like, okay, this is one of those costume things. So no, that's awesome. This kind of reminds me of you remember that time in like the late 90s when everyone got really into swing music for like 6 months, and everyone, like zoot suits and shit like that was everywhere, and then it disappeared, like pff, gone. But it's kind of one of those trends. So when it like when you see things like this that is either influenced by media or some trend that's going on, what does that look like behind the scenes? Are you guys trying to get on it while it's happening quickly, or how? I mean, it just seems like if you come up with a design and you're gonna make a clothing line and start, distributing it and selling it, that's a multi-step process. And in 2026, we have, fads and trends like pop in and out so quickly. How do you guys keep up with that?
I mean, part of it is you don't and you can't and probably shouldn't. But it really is a balance. So for me in like freelance work, for example, I think in the things that I've done, it's definitely been observing some of the trends, seeing like what's happening right now, what are things that are emerging that may be happening in the future. And kind of taking all of that information, it is a lot of research, honestly, and understanding the market, understanding what people are wanting. But the research part usually comes first. Sometimes there'll be a portion where you can test things as well. So you'll have like a small portion of the assortment where you can say, okay, let's see if there's appetite for this. So we'll just do small quantities, put it online, see if people are liking it, and that can usually give some great information too. But there's definitely a lot of work that goes into it. And then there's even depending on category too, because different category trends move differently. Like activewear, for instance, the trends tend to move a lot slower than something like dresses. Dresses, it's like every season there's like a new kind of it dress that pops up, whereas activewear, it might be maybe it's a color that you see throughout the year, but the silhouettes are kind of the same. So it's
Interesting.
definitely a little bit of everything for sure.
Well, I guess like I mean, there's you say activewear and immediately I think about like track suits, but there's only, something works, it's gonna work, you can
Exactly.
put whatever designs on it, but it's like people wear activewear to, be active, not necessarily be fashionable. But I understand that this is, you could do both.
For
With it.
sure.
Well, let me ask you this. With because obviously as, someone with on with neurodivergence, you're gonna have a high degree of creative intuition when it comes to things like this. How do you reconcile that when you're at work, when you're in the middle of something and because we have like this innate ability to be able to peek around the corner a little bit. We'll call it with our, predictive risk mapping, whatever you want to do. How do you handle that when you are, in the midst and you see something's about to happen and the other people on your team just don't, they don't recognize the pattern yet?
Yeah, that can be tough because I feel like neurodivergent people can find themselves in that situation a lot, whether it's at work or in personal life or whatever. But it's definitely hard to be in that situation. When I've previously been in that situation, I think I've tried a bunch of different things, honestly. I've tried doing nothing. I've tried trying to like blow the horn of like, okay, guys, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe let's do this instead. And then also kind of in between. But I'm definitely someone who's much more prone to say something and at least bubble it up of like, hey, these are the concerns I have. This is why I have those concerns. What do you think? And sometimes they're like, no, I don't think that's a concern. I'm like, okay. And sometimes like, oh, that's a good point, actually. I don't think we thought about that. But I will say, I think the environment definitely matters because if you're in an environment where that kind of conversation is championed and that's something that is sought after, then those environments, you tend to have much more success in having those kinds of conversation than if it was an environment where maybe it's harder to have like those open lines of communication.
I agree. I think a lot of it is, and we're starting to see this trend get a little easier as more and more neurodivergent professionals are entering the workspace, where especially leadership management is a little more educated and aware of neurodivergent cognition. And they're able to, keep that line of communication open. In a way, it wasn't always this way, and it's difficult to overcome that, especially if you're dealing with a lot of egos are involved. Because people, it's just one of these quirks of life that people will forgive you for being wrong. They won't forgive you for being right. And if you're right about something and then it comes out that you were right the whole time and you were talking to your boss about it and say, hey, if we don't do this, this is going to happen. And then, oh no, consequences. And then they look at you like it's, like you're the asshole. And it's like, well, I tried to tell you, but you didn't do it. But they would get, almost a sense of resentment about it. And thankfully, like I said, it's getting better. It's just, I understand what you mean by, you have to choose your battles. And it does take a lot of trial and error, and a lot of times we don't have a lot of runway for the error.
And that's the part that can be really tough. So I definitely understand why people fall on all ends because it is so specific to the circumstances. Like it could be a particular boss that's challenging where you have to navigate, like, how do we communicate through that, Or it might be a great environment where you can bring all these things up and everyone is pretty open and receptive. But I think for me, regardless of the situation I'm in, I will always lead with a collaborative spirit. Like, I'm not here to make people's lives hard. Like, I want to do this to make our lives easier. So let's see if we can come to some solution where we can all get what we need,
Absolutely.
So that's always the attitude I'm going to come at it with, which has helped a lot for sure. Because I think if you come in and you're not like, this is wrong, this is bad, do this differently,
Right.
people are much more receptive to, hey, here's a thing that I see that might cause us a lot of extra work in the future. We could do this thing now that would prevent that happening. While it might be a little sucky now, think about how much time we'd save on the back
Right.
end.
We're
But that can be hard though sometimes because it's hard to put in the work sight unseen to then get the result. A lot of times people want to see what it's going to be, what the result will be immediately, which can definitely be like a barrier to moving things forward for
It's
sure.
so funny because there's always this friction between autistic people and neurodivergent people when it comes to, like, I do not understand the neurotypical obsession with methods over results. Because we're very, like, any neurodivergent person is very results coded, and
Yes.
autistic people are just, they want the methods.
Yes.
And I can understand because you said at the start of it, the start of this episode where you like to get your systems in place to save some moves down the road. It makes sense to you. You got it all worked out in your brain. But now you have to explain that process in a way that the neurotypical mind can easily digest it. And that's where, it takes a lot more communication.
For sure, for sure. And it's not always easy.
Right.
Yeah.
It's but we're getting I like to think that we're getting a lot better with it
For sure.
as we go on. Okay, so some of the things you talk about, you understand with you've always said that, like, the heart of your work is the people work, creating spaces where people could feel seen, heard, clear. Can you walk us through what that actually means to you?
Yes. Which is funny because some of this actually came from the Generalist World event that we met at. Where we were talking about our unique skill stack of like, okay, we all do a lot of different things. What is the heart of all of that? And after conversation with you, other people, on our table and some reflection as well, I realized that that was really the heart of it all, was the making people feel seen, heard, clear, allowing people to be themselves. I think whether and if it's the things I'm actually making or just our interaction as I'm making that thing, I think that is something that I bring to pretty much everything I do, regardless of if that's like at the forefront of my mind, so I really do think that the meaning making part, because at the end of the day, it's like it's clothes.
Right.
Like they're clothes. It's not like changing the world or doing anything crazy like that, but I do appreciate that I can bring all of myself to that. I can bring my analytical mind. I can bring my curious mind and use that to basically impact the work that I'm doing that will impact people that buy it. So even though it's something that someone might not think of that much when they just like pick it up at the store and try it on, it's like, oh, this is cute. And it's like that went through hundreds of hands. And I really appreciate being able to put in the thought up front so that someone can just pick it up, put it on, it works, it's great, and they don't really have to think about that. So I think that's definitely a through line for all of my work, whether it be fashion, whether it be music. Music is a big thing for me as well. Like that thread of people feeling seen and heard. I think music is one of the most beautiful ways that you can express a full range of emotions. And also, sometimes people say things in songs that you've felt and you've never been able to put words to. And I think that is something that's really, really powerful, being able to kind of say that thing out loud that a lot of people have thought, that a lot of people feel seen by.
Right. That is, it's like you listen to a song and you get like goosebumps or something because it touches, you know, it really kind of affects you on a level. It's just really,
Exactly.
I really enjoy moments like those. One thing I did want to ask you about is the, so with, you know, with neurodivergence, dealing with both, systems thinking and creativity thinking, okay, and you know, science would have like right, left brain, you know, obviously analytical, creative, and you seem to mesh it together pretty well, you know, finding that common thread as far as helping people be seen, and seeing these projects, you know, come to fruition. What does that look like for you, to be successful? And this kind of touches on what you were talking about earlier, as far as when, you know, in a different job situation, what you need to be successful. What does success look like for you?
See, I feel like this is a question that I'm probably going to be asking myself forever because the answer will probably change depending on what's happening in life.
Okay, well,
But
tell you
right
what, Dara,
now,
tell you what, I will book you again for 1 year from today, okay?
there we
Well,
go.
and we'll come back, right? Well, we'll revisit. But all right, so today, as of you know, May 25th, 2026, what does success look like for you?
Right now, it is definitely the ability to create with purpose, and being able to create with people in mind, whether that be through fashion, through creative direction and art direction and music spaces, whether it be through my client work with brides and things like that. I think that is definitely what success is. It doesn't have to be this like big flashy thing of like, oh, all these people recognize. I think for me, that one-on-one, especially anytime where I can see the impact, is always honestly the best. Even if it's just in passing, or whether it's I'm literally sitting right in front of how my work has affected other people, I think that is definitely a huge thing that I realize drives how I think about success. Like the impact of how it touches people, how it helps people, how it maybe it's really just that this is the thing that they put on that is comfy, they know it works, and they can just throw it on and go out the house and they don't have to check themselves, you know? But to give that little extra layer of ease, to me, that's definitely success for sure.
It's fantastic. So it's like more of a one-on-one, you know, you get the one-on-one either like feedback or just that you can make an impact on a person that's measurable instead of just throwing out a, you know, a clothing line that I guess you could see your impact when it comes to like sales metrics and, you know, you designed a shirt that sold like, you know, X amount and that's one form of success. But I feel like that would be you might be inoculated against that a little bit from you know, insulated, that's the word, insulated from feeling that, as opposed to like one-on-one with a client. So I can understand. So when you are, so when you have your system side and your creativity side, I'll pull both pulling in the same direction. How does that actually work together?
Together definitely has been trial and error, but I think where I'm at now, they definitely feel much more hand in hand. So I will always lead with creative first. I'm much definitely much more of like a big picture thinker, like overarching, how do all the pieces fit together? So I always lead with that, and I think that helps me kind of set the direction, the pace that I want to go. And then it's a moment of, okay, we have this great idea. We have all these things that we can make, whether it be like a podcast I'm launching or a lingerie line, whatever it may be. So, but then it's like, okay, what do I actually need to support that? What do I need to make that happen? And that's where it's like rubber hits the road. What can I set up that will make this easier for me? Because if I already know my brain and I already know that starting things is really hard, like actually just the first step is often the hardest. So if I already know that about my brain, I'm going to make sure that the barrier to entry is as small as it can possibly be, because that is something that is a kindness to myself, because I already know that that's something that's hard, you know? So why would I make it harder? Like, let me try and make it easier on myself. But it definitely takes time. I've definitely made a system, abandoned a system, made a new one, abandoned it, made a new one.
Right.
I think I just, at this point, I'm like, that's how my brain works. That's part of the process. So instead of trying to tell myself, like, oh, well, you just need to figure it out, or like, you just need to pick something, I'm like, no, this is just part of my process. I know this is how my brain works. So I'm just going to incorporate that into the plan as much as I can and give myself space so that if I am learning or discovering things that do help or don't help, I can adjust and keep moving forward.
I love that. And I like how you phrase that as far as like starting being a kindness to yourself. Because it's like I have fallen victim to my own analysis paralysis so many times where it's so much is up in my head, and it's just I and the reason is with my ADHD side, it's this level of like perfectionism. And it's one of the biggest lessons I've had to learn is giving myself permission to fail. It's, because it's really, it's hard to do. And we live in this world, especially like in Western society, where it is, it's either, what did Ricky Bobby say? If you ain't first, you're last. So unless you can be perfect right out of the gate, it's this level of expectation. But it's an unrealistic expectation. And it's really so I have to like give myself, permission to fail. Okay, so if this doesn't work out, it's, we got out and we did it. We tried something.
Exactly. And it's part of the process. And if we know it's part of the process, let's expect it to be part of the process, give our space. But the mental hump can be very large, because it's very, very, very easy to get stuck up here in your brain and like the thinking and the planning and the analysis of it all without actually just making the first move to bring it into the world, you know?
It's I get it. All right, well, let me ask you something else about so with the creative process, it's I as a writer, I struggle sometimes to be done. I like to tinker, and especially when it comes to writing, it's like I could change this phrase, this one, that there's like a lot of little things that can be adjusted. What does that look like for fashion design? Because I know that as a creative, you're gonna have your urge to tinker, and get in there. What does that look like for you, and how do you know when enough's enough?
When I find the answer to that fully, I'll let you know. Because I think
Right.
it's very hard sometimes. Because, like you said, it's like, for me, I always want to do more. I always end up wanting to do more. Even something as simple as my nails, because I do my own nails. And I'm always like, oh, I'm going to do a cute little simple set. And then 3 hours later, there are jewels everywhere. It has 3D flowers. And I'm just like,
Right.
well. But I think a lot of it has to do with whatever the initial intent was. So if I'm like, okay, my intent is to bring this image to life. So say I sketched a wedding dress for someone, and my intent is to bring that image to real life. I'm not going to stop until I feel like the intent has been completed. But when it gets to a place where it's like I'm looking at what I've created, I'm looking at the original intent, and I'm like, okay, it's the same. We're in the same place. I think that's when I'm like, okay, we can put pencils down. It can be done. But I think with other things, it's definitely harder. With garments, there's definitely like a very visible like doneness, usually, where you get to a point and it's like, okay, there's not really much else I could do anyway, even if I wanted to, so it's done. But I think it's definitely harder with things like graphic design, things like brand direction, even this past art direction that I had done for this new music kind of experience, an intimate music experience called June's Room. And I was one of the people that was helping bring this to life visually. And working with the founder, Mercedes, we had a lot of images back and forth, a lot of images back and forth, a lot of iterations. I probably made maybe like 15 different versions of the final poster and had to really, really narrow down like, okay, which one do we really feel like is hitting the intent? But again, the intent is definitely, I think, the thing that helps me circle in on is it done or not? Because if you have a clear intent, I think that definitely helps illuminate when we can put pencils down. But even then, especially with events and things like that, oof, that is tough because there's always something you can add. There's always something you can do. But
Right. It's
even then, like, I definitely do want to make sure that even if there is something I can do, it doesn't always need that extra thing. And sometimes you just have to trust the original vision and trust that what you have done is enough. And that can be really, really hard when it doesn't. Sometimes it might not feel like it's enough, but it actually is, you know? So sometimes it really is just trusting yourself and that I did a good job. I can put the pencils down. I don't have to keep reworking it over and over and over again. It's great, you know? So definitely giving myself that affirmation sometimes too.
right. It's hard sometimes because it's I'm the same. I don't obviously I don't do my nails or anything, but I can recognize the trait of being a maximizer, and
Absolutely.
you know wanting to take it, and it's like, and I could get and I'll second guess myself even with good work. I'll be like, yeah, I did a good job, but did I do a great job? Can this be great? Can this be greater? Did I do the greatest job? And it's really difficult because, again, with that focus tunnel, I don't come with an off switch. And it's really, I think it takes a lot of self-awareness and knowing, having faith in yourself. You know,
Definitely.
trusting yourself to be able to do it. Because it's what are they? What's the phrase like? Continuous improvement via improvement. We're always like looking for ways to improve, obviously, in all aspects. We want to get better, we want to get more efficient, we want to have better productivity. But you can get to a point where it's too much. You
Exactly.
know, it's one of those things. All right, so I want to switch gears a little bit. Let's go back to talking about neurodivergence in the professional world. And obviously, with my podcast, I talk about what I call applied neurodivergence, which is our leveraging neurodivergent cognition. We talked about it a little bit with your systems, your systems thinking, your ability to take an idea and then navigate through everything and how to get it to fruition. What's been the hardest part of navigating your professional world as a neurodivergent person?
I think the hardest part, honestly, was that I didn't know I was neurodivergent when I entered. So once I started working in corporate America and started become as a fashion designer, I didn't know I was neurodivergent. So that was definitely the hard part of like, sometimes I felt like I was so capable, I had so much capacity, and sometimes I felt like I had zero. So trying to understand like what that crazy back and forth was definitely really, really hard. But I think as I began to learn more about ADHD, understand that I had ADHD, and also just try and help myself essentially, and that now I know this information, how can I better support myself? How can I set myself up for success essentially? And that made a huge difference, I think, in the way that I was able to navigate that space. Because I was able to, you can't always change like the spaces that you're in. Obviously, yes, you can impact and change can always be made, but more often than not, the space that you're in is going to change you more than you changing that space. So I definitely had to figure out the balance of what do I need to do to make sure I'm good? What do I need to make sure that my needs are being met, that I'm able to do this work sustainably? As well as like, are there things that I can help kind of push forward in the space where I know that's something I'm always going to do regardless of the space that I'm in? Because I'm like, if I'm going to do it for me and it'll be easier for me, odds are it would help other people as well. So I will always try and like push to get the most collective action possible, but also while understanding that often takes time. That takes people too, and you can't put all of that responsibility on your back as one singular person, you know? So it's definitely a balance of taking care of yourself, understanding your environment, and doing what it is that you need to do to make sure that you're going to be okay, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's important to realize that there is, what you can and cannot control. And it's something because I realize I have zero control over people, places, and things, full
Exactly.
stop. But I can control, my attention, my attitude, my actions, and ultimately my agency. That's something that we can control. So it is, so I've always had to struggle with, maintaining my, look at the bright side of things. As far as where my attention is, because that's going to dictate my attitude, how I feel about the room that I'm in, and ultimately that's going to dictate the actions. And it sounds like you have a really, really good handle on it. So let me ask you, what does like you still mask since it's, post-diagnosis and living, finally realizing that you are neurodivergent? Do you find yourself living the neurodivergent life authentically?
I think definitely much more authentically than I ever have. There are definitely still moments where I'm figuring out the balance of like, okay, how much do I want to show? How much of that do I want to be at the forefront? But I'm also just a very open person in general, so I'm like, I'm not really great at like compartmentalizing anyway. So I'm like, I pretty much show up the way that I am everywhere. And even if it isn't something that is like explicitly disclosed, because some places I've worked, I have officially, some places I haven't. It is definitely something that I lead in, even in with interviews when I got this current job. I was very mindful of how I was presenting myself because I was like, I'm not going to present myself as someone who's going to like come early and stay late every day and is, because I'm like, that's not realistic and that's not who I am. So I was very clear on like, if you provide these conditions, this is the work that you will get. And I found that to be really, really helpful in just being upfront about how it is that I work, the things that help me succeed. Because I'm like, if you set me up, I'm a huge asset. There's a lot of things I can do. I can do them a lot faster than most other people at a super high quality. So that's something that I've definitely learned to show as a strength because it is a strength. Obviously, yeah, there's the parts of ADHD where you're banging your head against the wall sometimes because you're like, this is a simple thing. Why is it so hard?
Right. Well,
But it's a both and, you know?
right. Well, what's something that you wish like managers, colleagues, industry, under at large understood about people like us?
Honestly, just be direct. Just be direct. I think it's really, really hard sometimes being neurodivergent and trying to understand like some of the office politics and like the things that people don't actually say but are like silent rules. I think those can be really, really hard to navigate sometimes. So I am always like, if we can make things explicit, if they could be clear, if they can be written down, I am always, always, always going to advocate for that because I think that helps. Not just neurodivergent people, but honestly, everyone.
Right. It's people don't, it's difficult to get a straight answer sometimes, for whatever reason. All right. Well, if let me ask you this, okay? If there's a younger neurodivergent creative listening right now, trying to figure out if there's a place for them or in this kind of work or just for them, what's something that you would want them to hear?
I think the biggest thing would definitely be that it's okay to like to do lots of different things. And there's nothing wrong with you for liking to do lots of different things. And that is actually a really cool strength that not a lot of people have. I think so much of the world and so much of kind of like holistic thought is very much you have to pick a lane, you have to do it your whole life. And if you don't do that, like, are you even successful? Like, what's, and I just don't believe in that at all. I think honestly, the most interesting people have the most unexpected, crazy life path where they're like, oh, I've done a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this. And I think that is something that should be embraced. And it shouldn't be something that is like a cause for shame or anything like that. I think it's something that should really be celebrated because There are so many innovations in the world that we all benefit from that come from neurodivergent brains. And it's because that's how we think. So I would just let them know, welcome to the club. It's really fun over here. There are some great people.
Right. Well, welcome to the island. We have cookies,
Yes,
right?
we have the best cookies.
Okay, so what is one thing that you would want the fashion industry at large to know?
I think something I would want the fashion industry at large to know is we need to prioritize the people. And I don't think that that's something the fashion industry doesn't know, but it's very easy to get into profits over people instead of people over profits. And obviously, it being an inherently capitalistic business of like, okay, well, I'm making this thing so you can buy, come buy my thing. Since that's already the nature, I'm always like, we need to make sure that we are prioritizing the people and that we are giving them value and giving them things that they actually want instead of just taking their money and giving them some BS, because a lot of
Right.
people do that.
Right. We'll give them what they, yeah, take their money, but give them pockets.
Exactly. So I'm like, if we're going to ask people to spend their hard-earned money, let's give them something that is actually worth that. So I think that would definitely be my word to the industry for sure.
Absolutely. Okay, we're just about out of time. Dara, where can people find you and your work?
Yes, so you can find me at my website, www.darathedesigner.com. You can see a lot of my work there. If you have different things, projects where you need a designer, whether it be fashion design, creative design and direction, or graphic, all of my stuff is on there. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Dara Broaddus, and then also on Instagram at becoming.dara.
Okay, and I'll put all the links in the show notes for everyone. All
Awesome.
right, Dara, thank you so much again for coming on.
Oh, of
And thank
course.
you
It's been a
again.
pleasure.
Okay, everyone, thank you for listening to another episode of The Sight Side, and we'll see everyone again on Thursday with another fantastic episode.